Sure. Okay. We're on chapter 20. In this chapter, we have, in some ways, a repetition, in other ways not, of an earlier episode. When Abraham came to Egypt because of famine, and he was afraid that Pharaoh would take Sarah, and so he claimed that Sarah was his sister rather than his wife, and used a... he said, in fact, it's true, she's, you know, the daughter of my brother, my brother, the daughter of my father, but not of my mother. But it was clear that it was also a deception, right? He was omitting the relevant fact, which is that she was also his wife. And it ended up all right because Pharaoh, first of all, is stricken with a skin disease, and therefore, presumably, is not able to have sexual congress with Sarah. And then he gives Abraham all sorts of gifts when she first comes into his palace, and then is restored to Abraham, and they go home, and nobody is hurt by the episode, but Abraham is enriched. Abraham does not seem to feel any guilt. He doesn't apologize for it. And that was several chapters ago, with no indication that this is going to happen again. So we come now to chapter 20, where, in fact, it does happen again, but with several twists. It's not quite the same as it was then. So first of all, remember, as we read this, it's always important to remember that chapters and verses are somewhat artificial. That when the Torah it was written, there was no break between different chapters. So we have literally just read of the incest between Lot and his daughters, and between that of Sodom. And remember that it is not expected that the reader is going to take, you know, a week break between one episode and the other. So those things should be fresh in our minds, and we should be remembering the destruction of Sodom and the incest of Lot and his daughters. And then it says, Vayisa Misham. Abraham journeyed from there. So what's the first question that you want to ask yourself?
Where?
Yes, but it does say, actually. It says to the region, first of all, you want to ask from where? Presumably from wherever he was. Where was he when we last saw him?
Watching Sodom.
So why does he journey? That's the question. When somebody takes a journey, you always say, why are you going?
Too salty,
right? Maybe there was nothing left, although there were cities around it. It's interesting to think. I'll tell you what Rashi says. Lehitrachek melat, sheyatza alav sham ra sheba al benotav. To distance himself from Lot because of what Lot did with his daughters. I mean, it's going to get around. If Lot's daughters are pregnant and somebody says, oh, so where are their husbands? And Lot looks embarrassed and kind of, you know, looks up at the ceiling or whistles. Or when the kids are born and they say, you know, it looks just like your father. It's amazing. I mean, the first one is obviously that Avram has to make some sort of name home for himself, but also it is true that he wants to distance himself from Lot and Lot's. I mean, this has happened before, but now Lot really exits the story. That's it. It's all over between Avram and Lot. And then it says, "Vayisamisham Avraham Artsa," that Abraham went in the direction. Now here they translate it the region of the Negev. Settled between Kadesh and Shur. But Artsa, Eretz, in the Bible and in Jewish tradition, when we say Eretz, we always mean Israel. So another interpretation of this which comes from Sforno, is that he wanted to go between two cities because he wanted to spread the word of God all over the land of Israel. And rather than just be in one city, also he's had a bad experience with cities, with Sodom, he figures he'll live at the midpoint between LA and San Diego and see if he can make excursions to both places and teach in both places. Yeah. There is actually, we did talk about it then. There is a good deal of modern commentary on it, and there's a little bit of ancient commentary, and you'll see in a minute that, in fact, Rashi comments on it in an oblique way, not in a direct way, but in an oblique way. So the other possibility of why Abraham is traveling between these two cities in Israel is that he wants to claim as much of the land as he can. And because God promised him this land. And one of the ways that you claim land is by walking around it, right? That's an ancient way. I think I mentioned before, although whether I did or not, I'll mention it again because it's such a wonderful story of Tolstoy's. Tolstoy has a short story called How Much Land Does a Man Need? And the story is about a man who is told the government says that all this land is unsettled, and basically you can have as much land as you can walk around in a day. So he sets off first thing in the morning, and he runs and pushes himself to go as far as he can. He runs and runs and runs and runs, and by the end of the day, he's so exhausted himself, he drops down and dies. And they bury him in 6 feet of earth. And that's the answer to how much land does a man need. Just as much as you're going to be buried in. Everything else is superfluous. So here, though, Abraham is trying to claim the land of Israel, and he claims it in part by walking around it, so that's why he's going from place to place. He's a wanderer. He's the one who's going to claim it for his descendants. All of that is from Abraham journeyed from there. All right. And where does he end up? He ends up in Gerar. He sojourns in a place called Gerar. So, Sarna in the Torah commentary to Genesis says he may have been trading, right? That's what you do. Actually, if you're a shepherd, and he takes a very common sense approach, if you're a shepherd, you do wander to feed your flock, and also if you have goods, you trade, and trade always entails going from place to place. Now, he doesn't settle. Notice it says Vayagar Bigrar, and Lagur could be a sojourn rather than a settling. That is, Abraham is still a ger. Same, you hear the same root, right? Vayigar, ger. Ger is a stranger. So even though the land is his, he's a stranger in that land because it's not his yet. And we'll see that he's a stranger because just as when he was a stranger and went to Egypt and was worried about the rules in Egypt, he's going to be worried about the rules in Gerar. He's not the king, and he's not the ruler, and as long as he doesn't have a say, he's going to feel like a stranger in that kingdom. Okay. So, once we know that he feels like a stranger, what does he do? It says, Abraham said of Sarah his wife, she is my sister. Now, what is the difference, if you remember, between this and the first time? He doesn't ask her. To which Rashi says, this is why I was saying he comments on it obliquely, and this is very interesting the way he puts it. And I want to read you the original comments because I was looking through it yesterday. All right, I was looking through it at the board meeting. He says, Khan here, lo natal reshut, he did not ask permission, ela al korcha, but rather against her will. Shelo betovata, because it wasn't for her good. Very powerful, right? That's all Rashi, who, by the way, gave birth only to daughters, and therefore probably had a certain sympathy with this. I mean, in fact, if you came up in the elevator, you see that the book that the that the library is doing this month is on Rashi's daughters, as a novel about Rashi's daughters. So Rashi, you know, Rashi is always very cryptic. In fact, there are lots of what are called super commentaries on Rashi. That is, people who explain what Rashi says. Rashi never wastes a word. And as you see here, that's all he has to say. He didn't ask her because it wasn't for her good. He doesn't say it was for Abraham's good or that's not a nice thing to do. He just leaves it at that. But here it's clear the first difference between this episode and the episode of Pharaoh is he doesn't go through the whole, remember with Pharaoh he says, I see you're beautiful. Of course, Sarah's almost 100 now, but we'll leave that aside for the moment. We'll come back to that actually as a question. But he doesn't say, I see you're beautiful, I'm afraid this will happen. He just refers to her as his sister. And in fact, there's an ambiguity in the Hebrew in the verbs because he says, Vayomer Avraham el Sarah, right? He says to Sarah, Ishto, his wife, Achoti, is my sister. That's how it reads literally. He says to Sarah, his wife is my sister. So it's like he's saying it to everybody. I mean, that's one interpretation. Is he saying it there? He's saying it to Sarah. He's saying it to Avimelech. He's saying it to the people in the street. Anybody who's around. Yeah. That's another possibility, is it obviously worked out well the first time. But even so, I mean, you still would think, so you say, you know, remember how well it worked out the first time? How about if we try this again? You know, maybe we'll get something out of it. But he doesn't do that. He doesn't do that. It's very, actually, Sarah is near 90, according to, if you look back on 17:17, you can see. So, Why does Abraham think that Avimelech will be interested in her? Sarna has an interesting comment. Yeah. First of all, the rabbis say that she was miraculously rejuvenated, right? That she was young again. Because the plain sense of the story is, in fact, that he's going to take her as a wife. And here you're reminded that the Bible often violates chronology, right? It doesn't keep to the sequence of a story so that it makes sense. And the rabbis know that, by the way. The rabbis say, Ein mukdam u'muchar b'Torah. There's no early or late in the Torah. In other words, yeah, maybe it seems like he couldn't possibly be interested in her, but don't pay attention. Think of her as a young woman, even though we know that she's near 90. So that's one. The other possibility is that Sarna says, in light of the subsequent relations between Avimelech and Avraham, and they do have a relation later, it's quite possible that the king's goal was an alliance with the patriarch for economic advantage. So maybe Avimelech thought, you know, as long as I'm with Sarah, I have an alliance with Abraham. If Abraham really has become as rich through the war with the kings as it seems, so you want to have, remember in the Middle Ages, the king was always trying to keep good relations with the nobles. And the relations between the, if you ever study medieval history, the wars between the kings and the nobles will drive you crazy because, you know, you have to keep track of them. And the nobles were a separate base of power because all of them had their own land, their own servants, their own crops, their own everything. They didn't really need the king so much unless they were fighting against other nobles or other countries. And maybe that's part of what's going on here. Abraham sort of has an independent power base, so Avimelech wants to have an alliance with him. Yeah?
What you were saying that this time he doesn't ask Sarah's permission.
Right.
When he says to Avimelech, because sort of he wanted me in father's house, right. I said to her, let this be the kindness that he shall do for me, whatever place we come to, say there and be my brother. Would that be a blanket?
Yeah, maybe when Abraham explains later, but we'll come to Abraham's explanation. It is possible that he said to her, and that this is the indication. Every time this happens, just you know, we go into sister wife mode. Yeah, it is possible, but it makes it curious, at least that he actually, the first time, does say, "You're beautiful. Please say that." And maybe it's just the Bible's way of introducing the reader to their arrangement. It doesn't have to introduce them again, because by now we know. Yeah.
Did any of the rabbis ever comment that perhaps Isaac was a product of Abimelech.
Yes. That's exactly why you will see that it explicitly says later that the womb was shut up in the palace because Isaac's born right after Abimelech. They all comment on that. All the medievals talk about it. That's why that verse is in there, because Isaac is born afterwards. So, okay. So, verse 3. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night. What? No? Okay. God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "You are to die because of the woman you've taken, for she's a married woman." Now, first of all, God doesn't come to Pharaoh in a dream. So already you feel, I mean, we're going to see this explicitly later, that Abimelech is on a different plane from Pharaoh. Abimelech, I mean, Pharaoh was, you know, but Abimelech is a good guy. He really is, as you'll see from what happened subsequently. And he must be, because otherwise, why would God come to him in a dream? Which is how God speaks to almost all the prophets in a dream, right? Not face to face. That's how he speaks to Moses. So, look at the next phrase. What does it say? Now, Abimelech had not approached her. And as was just commented, the reason, according to a lot of the medieval commentators, is so that you shouldn't think in the next chapter when she gives birth to Isaac that Abimelech is the father. Okay? And look at what he says. And this is an amazing and fascinating sentence. I'm going to read it first in the Hebrew. Hagoy gam tzadik taharog. Now, does that ring any bells with you? If it doesn't, then look back. Hagoy im tzadik taharog. If it doesn't ring any bells with you, then look back. Nope. To chapter 18, verse 24. I'm sorry, verse 25. Chalil alecha, it's terrible to you, ma'asot kadavar hazeh, to do this sort of thing. Lahamit, to kill, which is just like laharog, tzadik im rasha, the righteous with the guilty. Abimelech is saying the same thing that Abraham said to God, which does two things. First of all, it lets you know that Abraham's role in this is not as clean as it was previously with Pharaoh. And also that Abimelech, that God's standards with the non-Jewish world are supposed to be on the up and up too. Abimelech says the same thing. Remember, Abraham was saying that about non-Jews, about Sodom, and now a non-Jew is saying the same thing to God. Are you going to kill innocent people together with guilty people? And here, goy, by the way, just means nation or people, right? Sometimes not Jewish, but sometimes Jews are called goy. The goy kadosh, a holy nation, right? Goy just means a nation, okay? But who's the tzaddik? Abimelech is apparently the tzaddik. He says, "You're going to kill me the way you kill other people," which means that a non-Jew can be a tzaddik too. Now, there is another way. It's very interesting. In the Middle Ages, I'm trying to remember who, Chizkuni wrote this. He says that the tzaddik is Abraham. And what Abimelech is saying is, look, if you're going to kill me, you got to kill Abraham, because Abraham is the one who made this all possible. Abraham is the one who said, you know, she's my sister. So go ahead, kill me if you must, but you got to kill him too. Which was Abimelech's way of saying, you know, I know he's not going to kill Abraham. Yeah. That's the other very fascinating thing here, is that Abimelech seems to be not a monotheist. It doesn't say that. In fact, there's a hint later on that he's not a monotheist, a very, very subtle hint. But he seems to accept the God of Abraham. especially because God came to him in a dream. Now, he could easily believe lots of gods come to him in a dream, right? Maybe tomorrow another god will come to him in a dream, but tonight the God of Israel came to him in a dream and said, I'm going to kill you because you took Sarah. And he says, I'm innocent. Don't kill me. Yeah, Jane. We don't know. We don't know. We're going to talk about, we probably won't have time today, but Leonard Cass has an analysis that's really interesting of all the stories leading up to now, which he sees as the education of Abraham as a husband. And it's a great analysis, and we will trace, but it requires retracing our steps through the stories, and we'll take a look at it probably next time. Yeah. Just those two things we mentioned, I think it was right before you came in. One was the rabbi said that she was rejuvenated. The other is whether he was trying to build an alliance with Abraham, who was wealthy, and maybe that's why he didn't approach her. You know, I don't know. If he thought that he was really Abraham's sister and he was wealthy, so maybe he was trying to...
There's an awful lot of the story that is missing.
Yes. The question was, there's a lot of this that's missing. How much is allegory and how much is real? Well, first of all, when we get to the Akedah, we're going to, one of the many sessions, because we'll spend several sessions on the Akedah, I hope. One of them is going to be about how cryptic the Bible is, how much it always leaves out. I think it's probably true that this must reflect some kind of ancient custom, and there's been all sorts of research into it, the wife-sister motif. And it probably was true that it was not unusual in the ancient world to give your wife to the king to protect yourself. I would bet that that's true. And I think this story is going to be used, as we'll see, to in the end, repudiate in some ways that belief. So I don't know if it's meant literally, but it certainly is meant educationally, I think. Both to educate about Abraham, and also, I think, to educate about the nature of society, which we'll come to, which is why Abraham says he does it in the first place. Yeah.
I just want to have a question, which doesn't say here whether or not Abimelech has many wives the way many kings.
No, but I assume that he does. I assume this is not Abimelech's only wife. Yeah, one,
it's
two.
It's incredible what Abraham has done. He's given his wife away twice.
Yes.
Then he takes away her firstborn son.
Oh wait, let's not get ahead.
No,
I don't want to. I don't want to go there. I don't want to go there. We haven't even gotten to the end of why he did it yet. So let's not go beyond where we are, because yeah.
Just a quick note on the rejuvenation idea.
Yeah. Right.
And were able to rejuvenate themselves and realize their age.
Yes.
And there you can read autobiography of a yogi, very famous.
Yep.
And I see that you are living a life that is more metaphysically oriented, which obviously you're busy.
Yes. Although this is a stretch. A woman of 90,
yeah.
to be an object of desire to a king is a... Right. I'm just curious. Have you ever read, and I'm not asking this tongue in cheek, are there any of women who do that? Or
yes.
Just men? Women too?
Yes. Read autobiography of the yogi, talks about several
visual yogis who are very beautiful. At advanced ages. Okay, yeah. Well, last comment, and then we really got to move on. Yeah. Well, no, it seems to me, at least in this area, that they intend 90 to be seen as 90, right? Because by this time, when people are dying at ages 120, which is considered clearly a very advanced age, we're very close to our own terms of ages. It gets more and more realistic as you move more and more through the Bible. But okay. He himself said to me, she is my sister. And she also said, he is my brother. Okay? So it wasn't just Abraham. Sarah plays along with this. When I did this, my heart was blameless and my hands were clean. So you can't blame me, God, right? I was completely blameless in this. And this is, the Hebrew here is more eloquent than a translation can be. Robert Alter points this out in his translation. He says, first of all, Halohu amar li achotihi, didn't he say to me that she was his sister? And then the Hebrew's great. It says, Vihi gam hi, which means, and she, also she said that. It's like the way Alter puts it is he's sputtering with indignation. Right? And that little repetition lets you know. He says, he told me she was her sister, and she also said it. Right? Like, give me a break here. You're going to kill me. I didn't do anything. Yeah. I had no idea until you came to me in a dream. But you can't raise your voice in print. There's no exclamation mark. So when the Bible says, he gam he, she also she, you have to feel the force of what Avimelech is saying. He's really outraged. And you'll see later on he's outraged with Abraham too, because he was the dupe here. Now, Pharaoh didn't have any of this outrage, because you get a sense that, you know, maybe Pharaoh had spies, or Pharaoh could care less if he's his sister, he's his wife. Pharaoh would have taken her anyway. But Avimelech, you get a sense that had he known that she was his wife, he never would have touched her. Yes, exactly. He's a good guy, which means that who's in the wrong here? Abraham. You could make the argument before that Abraham wasn't in the wrong. He judged the society right. Egypt didn't care. But he completely misjudged Avimelech. And as you'll see later, unlike the first time, Abraham sort of apologizes. Right? The first time, Abraham doesn't apologize. The first time, Abraham's just happy to get out of there with the goods. But this time, he does. And God said to him in the dream, I knew that you did this with a blameless heart, so I kept you from sinning against me. Which is another emphasis of they didn't have intercourse. Right. That was why I didn't let you touch her. Therefore, restore the man's wife. Since he is a prophet, he will intercede for you. I'll come to that in a second. To save your life. If you fail to restore her, know that you shall die, you and all that are yours. God just wants to make sure. You know, it's very easy to say, I never would have done it. Then as soon as the policeman turns his back, you do it. But God's saying, you haven't gotten off until you actually restore Sarah, otherwise you will die. Now, this is a good time to stop for a minute and talk about two things. First of all, I kept you from sinning against me. This is a very powerful line, because what sin is he talking about?
Adultery.
Which is a sin against whom? That's the point. Adultery is not only a sin against a human being, it's a sin against God. God says explicitly, sinning against me. Doesn't say, I wouldn't let you sin against Abraham. He says, I wouldn't let you sin against me. So this is, I mean, we know this from the Ten Commandments, that the Ten Commandments are bein adam lemakom, the first five are between man and God, and the second five are between man and man, or between people, and the second five includes adultery. But here the emphasis is that's also a sin against God. Yeah. Well, it claims that he claims not, right? It claims that God's that they were right stricken with a skin disease and it wasn't allowed. Also, it's not as though God will never allow a sin against God, right? God permits all sorts of sins. I mean, God permits idolatry and adultery and murder and theft and everything. But at least here he's defining it's standard for God to allow it. It's unusual for God to forbid it, right? Or to prevent it, I should say. Not forbid it, but prevent it. And the second point here is what a prophet is. The prophet... Normally, when you ask most people what's a prophet, they say someone who can tell the future. But actually, first of all, prophets aren't by and large people who tell the future, although they do make some future comments and future predictions. Prophets are people who, first of all, tell the present. That is, if you keep acting this way, I can see, they extrapolate trends. You know, I can see bad things will happen to you. And that's because they understand the nature of the way God works in the world now. Not, it's not a prediction like a miraculous thing that's going to happen in 20 years. They're saying, given what the way you behave, that's why prophecies are conditional. If you keep doing this, this will happen. If you repent, this won't happen. Now, the people virtually never repent, so it always happens. But that's what prophecy is supposed to be. Yochanan Mofs, in particular, who I don't know if he's still teaching at the Jewish Theological Seminary. He taught there for many years, but he had multiple sclerosis and became worse and worse as he got older. He did a lot of work and in some ways helped change people's conception of a prophet, because he talked about the fact that the prophet, and it wasn't unprecedented, other people talked about it, but Mofs is the one who really advanced this idea that the prophet is essentially an intercessor, someone who comes between. That is, it is the prophet's role to plead God's case to the people and to plead the people's case to God. That's what the prophet really does. The prophet, Heschel put it beautifully, of course, because Heschel was Heschel. He said, the prophet is the man who can hold God and man in one thought simultaneously at all times. The rest of us, you know, sometimes we think about God, sometimes we think about human beings. The prophet never loses either one. So that's why when God says, I'm going to destroy the people, Moses says, you cannot destroy this people, and then goes down to the people and says, how dare you do this against God? Right? The prophet is both. And so here, Avraham is going to end up praying for Avimelech. Why? Because it's his job as a prophet to intercede on behalf of Avimelech before God, just as it's his job clearly in the case of Sodom to intercede on behalf of the people of Sodom before God. On the other hand, his whole life's work is representing God to the people. So it works both ways. And it is a beautiful idea that a prophet is somebody who represents both, right? And this, by the way, is an idea in the Hasidic movement in particular, some of the famous Hasidic rebbes took upon themselves, like Rebbe Yitzchak of Berdichev, who was known as the defender of Israel, whose job was to defend Israel to God. And it's a very powerful idea, and you see it, I think, here for the first time, and if I'm not mistaken, this is the first time, no, I'm not mistaken, because it says it here, the first time the word Navi is used. This is the first time someone's called a prophet, and that's what his role is. Right, to intercede, yeah.
And it shows that even a prophet can...
Oh, yeah, prophets do all sorts of bad things.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about
that's
perfect. But notice what God says. Because he's a prophet, v'yit palel ba'adcha, he will pray for you. Now, they translate as intercede, but again, this is the first time, this will be the first time that anyone in the Bible prays to God. People have built altars to God, but nobody has actually said a prayer. And we will we'll extrapolate on that when we get to it. Okay, yeah.
Why does he pray to God?
We'll see in a second when we come to the prayer. Yeah.
There's a star after the Hatom. What is that star from?
Because it says that it's missing an aleph. Normally, you would have an aleph at the end of Chato, and here it's not there. So they make a note to let you know that aleph. That the Aleph is, normally the Aleph would be there and it's missing. Why it's missing, then you can, you know, yeah.
It seems like Avimelech has his own relationship with God.
It does seem that way.
So why does he need someone to intercede?
I'll read Sarna here. Sarna says, by forcibly abducting Sarah, Avimelech has made Abraham an aggrieved party. Because after all, he did take her, right? It doesn't give any indication that he asked. And by the way, you'll notice that that's one thing that he doesn't address with God. He says, I didn't touch her, but he doesn't say, okay, I did take her, right? And he did take her. It doesn't say he asked her, he whatever. So he's made Abraham a grief party. It's only fitting that the one wrong should intercede on behalf of the wrongdoer. Moses similarly prayed for his sister Miriam, who had defamed him, and Job beseeches God on behalf of the friends who misjudged him. So even though Miriam has her own relationship to God, you still, the one who is wronged has more credence in a way to come before God and say, just like in a court case, the person who's wronged can say, I don't want to sue, but the person who's injured, but the person who's done the wrong, can't say, I don't want him to sue. And remember, it's the Yom Kippur idea also, which is you have to apologize to the person you've wronged and get their forgiveness, or God can't forgive you. Let's go on to verse 8. Early next morning, Abimelech called his servants and told them all that had happened, and men were greatly frightened. Okay, they don't want to die either, because God said, all that is yours. Then Abimelech summoned Abraham and said to him, what have you done to us? What wrong have I done you that you should bring such a great guilt upon me and my kingdom? You've done to me things that ought not to be done. What then, Abimelech demanded of Abraham, was your purpose in doing this thing? Now this is a very long, repetitious speech for the Bible. And I think if we were putting this in English, we would say it was a rant. He's furious at Abraham, that Abraham almost got him killed. And that's really what happened, and made him do something wrong, which he didn't want to do, right? And so he says to him over and over, why'd you do this wrong thing? Why did you wrong me like this? How could you have wronged me this way? What was your purpose in wronging me this way? Because remember, Abimelech has no idea that Abraham thinks he was going to kill him. It's a vast gulf in perception, and in fact, what Abraham says, I thought, said Abraham, surely there's no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. That Abraham has to now realize that he was completely wrong in this assumption. Because not only does Abimelech prove him wrong, but now go back up to verse 8. Why are the men greatly frightened? Because there is a fear of God in this place. God said, I'm going to kill you, and they're afraid of it. So the text is very... it's very clever in the way it shows you Abraham's wrong before Abraham even makes his excuse. And it says it explicitly. They're terrified of God's wrath. But Abraham thinks, there's a famous line in Dostoevsky that in The Brothers Karamazov, that without God, anything is possible. And this is a line that's always quoted by people who say that you need God to have morality in society. And that's what Abraham is essentially saying. If there's no God here, people will do whatever they want because there's no restraining force on them. And whether that's true, there's a very interesting argument about whether it's true that you can have a moral society without God, but surely Abraham didn't think so. And he lived in a world that proved that he was right. I mean, he just came from Sodom, remember. That's the other thing that we have to always remember what just happened. He came from Sodom, and then he saw what happened with Lot. And the whole idea was that paganism breeds this sexual immorality as well as cruelty. And so he comes to Abimelech and it's just not possible for him to assume that Abimelech is going to be nice to his wife. Yeah.
It seems to me that juxtaposition of Sodom and the land of Abimelech really should teach us that the others can be nice as well as bad.
Exactly so. Nope, it is not an accidental. And in fact, somebody, I don't remember who I read that says that, but I think that that's exactly the intention, which is there are non-Jews who act like this, and there are non-Jews who act like that. And you can't lump them together because Abimelech is clearly a good guy. It's possible. Abimelech means the father of king. It could. I don't know. I don't know whether this. I haven't done any research on the name, and he doesn't say anything about it. I don't know if. Let me just see if any of the commentators say anything in particular about the name Abimelech. Let's see. Abimelech, Melech Grar. It's in verse 2. And remember, by the way, look at the end of verse 2, by the way, it says, and Abimelech sent and took her, right? So he does take Sarah. He's not completely blameless. It's not like Abimelech is, Okay, I don't see any comment, but I will look it up, because it may well be that there are, I would guess that there's a midrash on what the name Avimelech means. All right. So now, and then, okay, so first Abraham gives his real reason. Then he gives his waffly, weaselly reason. And besides, she is in truth my sister, my father's daughter, though not my mother's, and she became my wife. Okay, but he didn't add the last part, that she became my wife. And to say, you know, to omit that, if a child says to you, when you say, I don't know, did you take the ice cream? And they say, I haven't even been in the kitchen. But they don't tell you that their brother brought the ice cream into the living room and they took it there. Later on, you say to them, you knew exactly what I meant, right? And it is clearly a lie by omission to say she's my sister. It's very weak. This is not Abraham's finest moment. So when God made me wander from my father's house, I said to her, let this be the kindness that you shall do to me. Whatever place we come to, say of me, he is my brother. Now, does that constitute an apology? I would say it's certainly closer to an apology than you got with Pharaoh. And he does explain his reason, that he was afraid that Avimelech would take her. So Avimelech doesn't push it too far, because he already knows that that God is on his side and on Abraham's side, and maybe Avimelech also knows that, you know, kings have absolute power. So this is a reasonable fear in that world. Abimelech took sheep and oxen, male and female slaves, and gave them to Abraham and restored his wife Sarah to him. This is not, by the way, what happens with Pharaoh. Here it's restitution. For Pharaoh, he gives it to him at the beginning. When he first takes Sarah, it's like a bride price. So this is a much healthier event, so to speak. And Abimelech said, here my land is before you. Settle wherever you please. And this also is very interesting. Pharaoh doesn't do this either, but Avimelech does. And to Sarah he said, I herewith give your brother. Yes. Notice, which is clearly, right, clearly a shtuch, yeah, as we say. He's clearly like twisting the knife in. 1,000 pieces of silver. This will serve you as a vindication before all who are with you, and you are cleared before everyone. He does not pointedly say, and your brother is cleared before everyone. It's Sarah whom he feels is guiltless in this, because he took her, right? And he knows he took her, and only Avraham could. I mean, I guess, given the position of women in the world, she couldn't have said, don't do this to me, I'm his wife. I mean, that probably really would have been taking her life into her hands. So instead, he says, now, it's when he says, what is it, verse 16, when he says you, he says itach, which is the feminine. So it clearly doesn't refer to both of them, right? It refers to her. And so you understand that he's letting her know how he feels about her and how he feels about Abraham. And here is the first prayer. Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Avimelech and his wife and his slave girl, so they bore children. Because not until the very end do we discover what has happened. For the Lord had closed fast every womb of the household of Avimelech because of Sarah, the wife of Abraham. Nobody in the palace bore children for as long as Sarah was there. Okay. What's that? It's a very good question. Yeah. What do they say? Yeah. Every orifice was closed. So then that would be a day, right? Would already be, you know. Although, yes, although it doesn't, it says Rechem in the Bible, it says womb, but my guess is, there you just saw, this is actually great, I love this, there was the Midrashic process right in front of you. You saw, closed up the womb. You thought to yourself, well, she had to be there for a long time for them to notice that the womb was closed up. And why would she be there for that long? Why would God let her be there for that long? You could imagine the rabbis worrying about the same thing. So what did they do? They said it wasn't just the womb. It was every orifice. And in fact, it happened right away. That's exactly the kind of stimulus and response, so to speak, that creates midrash. We don't like the idea that Sarah was there for months, for example. The other kind of midrash that you could do with this is someone was about to give birth and they couldn't give birth and couldn't, or maybe many people, I don't know how many people were in the king's palace. Many people. But I don't see anything the only other thing that might have stimulated this idea that every orifice was closed up is look at verse 18. Ki atzor atzar Adonai. The repetition of atzar, which means closed. The Bible often does this. We usually say it's for emphasis because we don't exactly know what this meant in ancient Hebrew. But it says, because closed God. That's the literal translation. So maybe the rabbis put those two together, how long he was there and the fact that closed is repeated, and said not just wombs were closed, but everything was closed. Yeah. And I'll come back to that in 1 second. Oh, go ahead. They can't hear you.
When Abimelech is saying, settle where everything is, it seems more than just generous. It seems almost as though he really does have real feelings for Sarah. He doesn't want her to leave his youth. He wants to keep her.
That's a nice idea. I like that idea. He says, when Abimelech said, here's my land, settle wherever you please, it seems like he doesn't want Sarah to go away. Yeah. He would say, go away, which is what Pharaoh did. Pharaoh said, go away. But Abimelech doesn't. Maybe. That is a nice idea. Maybe Abimelech thinks, you know, you're not so safe with this guy Abraham around. Why don't you stay in the land? I'll take care of you. I did want to say, by the way, before we take the other comment, this idea, the flip side, I'm still turning over in my mind this midrash about all the orifices being closed. You know that you say a prayer every single morning about orifices being open, right? Chalulim, chalulim, nikavim, which means every passage and orifice in my body, we thank God for their being open and closed appropriately. It's a prayer that you say after you go to the bathroom in the morning. And the idea that you say a prayer for that is at first it strikes you as strange, but on second thought is in fact both appropriate and beautiful, because the truth is that the proper functioning of your body has more immediately to do with how you feel in the world than almost anything else. You know, it's what, when Buber talks about the I-thou experience, which is the total experience of another human being, he says it resembles nothing so much as pain. And I remember when I first read that, I thought about that line for a while, and then I realized when you stub your toe, for a minute, nothing else exists in the world. Nothing, right? Then someone says, are you okay? And you get angry at them. But first, for a second, nothing else exists. Pain is total. Your body can take you over in a second. And so to pray for the good, for the health of your body, it makes perfect sense. Okay, we had a couple of hands. Yes, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah.
The Etz Chaim has another explanation for it. It says,
yes.
For Rechem, enjoy restoration of sexual vigor.
Right. Oh, I see. So it says that people couldn't have intercourse, basically. Right. Yeah. Well, right, because impotence is one of the midrashim, one of the rabbis says that what happened was impotence, as a matter of fact. And the reason that they say that is because they want it to be, I mean, they say one of the reasons is they want it to be a punishment for that Avimelech would feel. And if it's just people not giving birth, Avimelech wouldn't necessarily feel that as a punishment to himself, but impotence he would, yeah.
Don't know.
It's a good question, but it doesn't. I don't know of any midrash that says, right.
So
but it doesn't say what. I don't know.
Favor.
I don't know.
That
I don't know. But we do know that people would spend time in a harem before becoming, usually before being brought before the king. Look at Esther, right? She spends time being prepped, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Prophet,
which is throughout the later part of the history, and Esther is given by Mordecai to the king, and she was given right. Yeah, there definitely is a similarity here in those stories. Yep. That's true. Well, last comment. Yeah. Yeah, I do think that that's true, that God, I mean, look, it is God who makes sure not only that Avimelech doesn't sin, but that Sarah doesn't sin. I mean, that's true that it works both ways. It's not just that Avimelech doesn't commit adultery, but God doesn't allow Sarah to commit adultery, which presumably she would have done. Yeah, one more, and then I want to wrap up with a comment. Yeah.
Abraham goes from Sodom to wherever he is.
Right, to Gerar. It's not that far. It's not that far because there's no, remember that there's no such a thing as a country at the time. And what there are small principalities, and they're run differently, and they have different kings, and the kings change, and they're always at war, and traveling is dangerous, right? And different societies are very different, and even though they may have some customs in common, you know, they come from different origins. All those sorts of things are true. So when you read the Bible and you hear about all the different, the Ammonites and the Moabites and the Perizzites and the Jebusites and all those people who lived in Canaan at the time and the Philistines, we don't even know how different they were because all we have left from them, apart from a couple biblical mentions, are some pottery. You know, we don't have writings. And Semitic pottery tends to be the same, but there were different gods and different pantheons and all the things that, yeah, and the further away you are, the more it seems alike. So, for example, people in the West used to think of everybody in the Soviet Union as alike, right? But Estonians and Latvians and Ukrainians and Czechoslovakians and Poles and Hungarians, they're all very, very, they're as different as French and Italians and Americans and Canadians, sometimes more different. But So the further back you pull the lens, the more people seem alike. But on the ground, things were very different in different places, which is why you can understand synagogues used to be the place that people would stay when they would wander, because hotels were dangerous, inns were dangerous, people's homes were dangerous. You know, and this is a theme in novels and things until very recently, where people, remember, did any of you ever see Les Mis? Remember Master of the House? The guy, I mean, that's a perfect example. When you have an inn by the road, you cheat people when they come by and all of that. And, you know, it was a very, very dangerous world. And that's one of the reasons why traveling was so unusual and so perilous, and also why explorers were so venerated. You know, it wasn't like it is now. When we think that traveling is dangerous now, right, because of terrorism or, I mean, it's nothing compared to what it once was. Okay, so next time I want to do Cass's analysis, because it's really interesting, of all the Abraham. We're going to do the Abraham, basically, wife-sister motif stories. What is it supposed to teach us? What does Abraham learn through it? Does he learn anything? And have we? Okay.